Hello, everyone. I'm Jim Paymar, and you are listening to The Big Shift, the podcast that looks at the seismic changes our world and our country confront. Perhaps the most important aspect of the American way of life is our justice system. The courts are a pillar of our democratic society. A jury trial is a constitutional right. Our founding fathers believed the right to be tried by a jury of our peers was the highest law of the land. It's included in the Sixth and Seventh Amendments of the Bill of Rights. But our court system is under fire. Local courts have been chastised for convicting people of color at a far greater rate than whites. The system often compels innocent people to plead guilty. Different courts in adjacent jurisdictions yield different penalties for the very same crime. High-level white-collar executives are rarely prosecuted for serious crimes. The highest court in the land, the U.S. Supreme Court, has been accused of becoming a partisan appendage of the Republican Party, with six of the nine justices being appointed by the GOP. Three justices were appointed by ex-President Donald Trump, while President Barack Obama was denied one appointment to the high court. To discuss these critical issues impacting all of our lives is Ron Cuby. Cuby is a nationally known criminal defense and civil rights attorney who's worked on some of the most high-profile cases in America, including New York's vigilante shooter Bernard Goetz, terrorist Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, who orchestrated the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, and mass murderer Colin Ferguson. He was a partner with famed attorney William Kunstler, one of the most important civil rights lawyers of the 20th century. Cuby has also hosted national TV and radio programs. Ron, thanks so much for taking time to join us on The Big Shift.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim. Your audience may not know, but we go way back together to the days of radio, to the days of WABC, and it's just a pleasure to hear your voice again.
I've followed your career very closely. Anytime your name comes up in the news, I definitely read every article. Ron, you've been an attorney, I believe, for 40 years since graduating from Cornell Law School. And you've tried hundreds of cases in your career, many quite controversial. During your time in courthouses around the country, do you see the system as being equitable? Does it deal equally with those who are charged with crimes? And is punishment meted out fairly?
Those are excellent questions that have, unfortunately, very easy answers. The answer to all of them is no. This system is not now, nor has it ever been, an equitable system. It's influenced primarily by issues of class and issues of race. And historically, we have seen people of color being over-policed, over-arrested, over-criminalized, and over-sentenced. And by over, I mean that white people under similar circumstances would not have faced the same consequences of the criminal legal system. And that's been the case for a very, very long time in America.
Justice has never really been blind in America. That's why we have the highest incarceration rate per capita in the world. We have 2.2 million people locked behind bars right now. And if you're black, your chances of being locked up are absolutely astounding. One out of every 15 people imprisoned across the world, is a black American incarcerated in U.S. jails. Would you call our penal system a form of institutionalized racism?
The criminal legal system has always been institutionalized racism. Ever since the days when Jim Crow supplanted the days of slavery, the system has existed largely, but not exclusively, but largely to maintain social and political and state power control over people of color. And it's, of course, been remarkably successful in doing that. But I don't want to sound all gloom and doom. I think that we have made a lot of progress over the past 10 or 15 years. There's been a large movement in favor of de-incarceration, mass incarceration, which was very much a phenomenon in the 80s and 90s and early 00s, has dropped off dramatically. And I think there's a general social recognition today from both liberals and conservatives that incarcerating large numbers of people is simply counterproductive. It destroys the lives of the people incarcerated. It destroys their families. It yields no social good for the most part, and it's tremendously expensive, especially in comparison with other forms of correction that are available.
Well, you remember the Rockefeller drug laws. That resulted in thousands and thousands of people being locked up here in New York and across the country because a lot of other states followed what was going on here in New York. Those laws put people away for peddling marijuana for decades.
Subsequently, the Nixon administration official, I think it was H.R. Haldeman, who acknowledged that the war on drugs was really just an attempt to conduct a war on African Americans. They just could say it like that. The Rockefeller drug laws, which provided for a penalty of 25 to life for the sale of 2 ounces of cocaine.
Jesus. Yeah.
These laws were enacted in response to the opioid epidemic in the late 1960s. They remained in effect. And one of the things we know they did not do was they did not stop the crack epidemic of the 1980s and 1990s. No matter how draconian the laws, we still had the crack epidemic. We still had mass arrests and mass incarceration. And finally, the Rockefeller drug laws were repealed and replaced with more sensible forms of correction for the issue of drug use and drug sales. Marijuana is now legal in the state of New York for recreational use. I never thought I'd see the day, but of course, then again, I stopped smoking a long time ago. So, I used to have to walk 5 miles in the snow just to buy pot.
I did a program called America Under Siege, and this was during the crack epidemic. And I remember driving up to Harlem one day, and we were on the lookout for any drug dealing that was going on. And I remember seeing a cement block being pulled out of a building and a transaction taking place. Now, this is the way that crack was being dealt with at the time. But, you know, the majority of cocaine use was by white people, and white people weren't being arrested at nearly any level that black people were being arrested for using the same drug that was made into it a different form, the form of crack. It was totally black and white, so to speak, in terms of arrests and convictions.
It absolutely was, and there is no evidence that crack cocaine is any more dangerous than powder cocaine. Powder cocaine, as you point out correctly, was very much the drug of choice of the white middle and white upper class in the 1980s. I remember at Cornell Law School, the corridors were awash with cocaine. It was freely available and everybody was doing it, and it was considered to be very cool. And I can assure you, there were no local, state, or federal police knocking down the doors at Cornell Law School to drag away law students.
Nope.
There weren't. Down the hill, in Ithaca, New York, where crack was being used, you did find that kind of very aggressive law enforcement.
Let's turn for a moment, if we could, to the Supreme Court of the United States of America. A Gallup poll that was released this year on public confidence in the U.S. Supreme Court. The court's rating hit a historic low with only 25%. That's like 1 in 4 Americans reporting that quite a lot or a great deal of confidence that they have in the court. We've also seen Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito involved in scandals linking them to billionaire donors, producing conflicts of interest. I mean, what does this tell you about our highest court?
The politicalization of the Supreme Court is not a new phenomenon. It's been a political institution since its founding. But it has never been this overt and this controversial, and it has rarely sided so often with the economic and political interests of the people who appointed those justices. The Supreme Court is really known as the weakest branch of government in the sense that it has no capacity to, you know, have its own militia or police force. It can't raise or levy taxes. It really depends upon the other branches of government to fulfill its mandate and to adhere to its rulings. It has no independent enforcement power. And that's why its credibility as an institution is vitally important. And I think it's lost a tremendous amount of that credibility really over the past decade or so, and particularly during the Trump years where, you know, President Trump announced in advance he was going to choose justices who would overturn Roe v. Wade. And when those justices were asked about that, they dodged the question repeatedly, dodged in lawyer-like ways, and then dutifully voted to overturn Roe versus Wade. We have a Supreme Court that is far to the right of where most Americans happen to be and with what most Americans believe. We'll see how far that court goes.
It's interesting that not only is the Supreme Court coming under scrutiny, but Americans' trust in the judiciary as a whole has been trending downward as well. It's reached a new low with just 47% of Americans having a great deal or fair amount of trust in the judicial branch. And we've seen court systems becoming increasingly politicized. If we can't have faith, Ron, in the justice system, are we heading down a slippery slope of losing our democratic values?
Let me again be a happier glance at that statistic. The fact that 47% of the American people actually do trust the judiciary as a whole places it well above Congress and well above the current president, the past president, and pretty much the president before that as well. So the judiciary as a whole isn't doing great, but it's doing better than other branches of government. And it still is the place where people go to resolve their disputes, be they interpersonal disputes or their disputes that are fraught with much heavier value systems. And people, as a general rule, still believe that they are going to be heard in a fair fashion, governed by the rules of evidence. And people generally still believe that the decisions that are made, especially by juries in trial courts, are going to be fair decisions, even if they don't like the ultimate outcome. So I think the courts are a good deal more resilient right now than the other branches of government.
So you're more optimistic than pessimistic about the basic rule of law and justice being dealt to the American people.
I'm cautiously optimistic, although I will say the 2024, because of the four Trump indictments, two federal indictments, one in New York State, one in the one in the state of Georgia. Hard for me to keep track of all the different jurisdictions. Those indictments and what happens to them, I think, are going to be the ultimate test for the American legal system, whether it will adjudicate these claims fairly, whether the president, the ex-president, will be held to account for actions he engaged in, if in fact he engaged in those actions, and whether the American people as a whole will accept those decisions. I think 2024 is going to be decisive as to which way our legal system goes, and well, hence our democratic system.
Let's take a look at some of these high-profile legal cases, some of the highest to ever hit the American judiciary, and you've touched on it. The former president of this country, Donald J. Trump, who we know well from covering him in our days as journalists in New York, he's now been indicted in four different jurisdictions, New York, Washington, D.C., Florida, and Georgia. He's been charged with 91 criminal counts. Do you think there's a chance that he will be convicted in any of these venues before the election in November 2024?
If these trials go forward, And that remains an if because former President Trump has now gone to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court is going to hear his claim of presidential immunity. Mm-hmm. But if these cases go forward next year, in fact, do go to trial, I think that there is a substantial likelihood that he will be convicted in one or more of those indictments based upon my review of the evidence. And I think there's a substantial likelihood that following such a conviction, he will be sentenced to a term of imprisonment. I also think it's very likely that he will remain free on some sort of bail pending appeal. Suddenly, conservatives will like the changes in the bail laws. And yay, he'll remain free on bail pending appeal until his cases are finally resolved after trial in the nation's highest courts. His strategy is fairly clear. Delay these cases, win the election, and then take over the Justice Department, dismiss the cases against him that he can dismiss, the two federal cases, and use the machinery of the Justice Department to go after the district attorney in Manhattan and the district attorney in Fulton County. That would be a dark day for the legal system. And we're not there yet, but that's one place where this is headed.
Not just a dark day for the legal system, but a very dark day for the country. That we've basically said that there are people, an ex-president, for example, who is above the law.
Who are not just above the law, not just beyond the reach of the law, but are able to use the machinery of an independent Justice Department to pursue high-profile vendettas against his opponents, which is what he said he's going to do.
Yes.
I mean, it's not like, you know, Richard Nixon sort of secretly maneuvered the IRS against his political foes and quietly maneuvered the Justice Department against anti-war activists and others. This is overt. It's out in the open, and people know what it is they're voting for.
It's basically like when Adolf Hitler said that he was going to do certain things, like annihilate the Jewish people, like go to war, like take over Europe to make the European continent part of the German Reich, he went ahead and did it. It's like Sinwar, it's like Yahweh Sinwar of Hamas saying exactly what he's going to do and then doing it.
I'm going to stand away from historical comparisons. Mm-hmm. I think that what he has said he's going to do, based upon what he's done in the past and who he's currently in the process of hiring to do what he said he's going to do, is ominous enough without references to Hitler or Hamas or anybody else.
Well, he's talking about concentration camps in the United States to round up immigrants and send them back to Latin America and South America and China and India, wherever else they're coming from, Afghanistan.
Indeed.
He's talked about building the wall again. He's talked about retribution against his political enemies. He's going to be a dictator on day one. What does that actually mean?
Right. What does that actually mean? But only on day one. I mean, we have no idea what these things actually mean in practice, except for what we know he would be capable of doing once the levers of executive power were placed back in his hands. And mm-hmm. and that's why that's not a chance this country should take. As much as people dislike Joe Biden, as much as people are wishing that maybe we could have some young person, maybe somebody in their 60s, a veritable child running, as much as we wish that maybe we could have a woman or another person of color or some more diversity, at this point, those issues, sadly, are no longer on the table. This election is going to be between Donald Trump or Joe Biden.
Yeah.
And you're voting for one or you're voting for the other, no matter who it is you say you're voting for.
You know, it seems that Trump's modus operandi is always, and we've known this for a long time, Ron, is delay, 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 appeal, 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 file a new motion every other day, run out the clock. And if he were to be reelected in November 2020, if he were to be reelected in 2024, November, would it be possible for him to pardon himself on the two federal indictments that he was convicted? Let me just do that one again.
Right.
It seems his modus operandi is delay, 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 appeal, 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 file a new motion every day, run out the clock. If he were to be reelected in November 2024, could he possibly pardon himself on the two federal indictments if he was convicted?
Well, there's two questions there. The first is, you know, we're making the assumption that these cases will be completed fully by the time of the next election. And that's not a safe assumption. It's not even a rational assumption. The trials mm-hmm. might go forward, but the appeals will continue.
That could go on for years.
And that could go on for years. But as soon as he becomes president of the United States, he can direct the Justice Department to concede error in the trials and move to dismiss the charges.
Mm-hmm.
If alternatively, there is no reason in the Constitution why a president cannot pardon himself. I know constitutional scholars debate this issue, and you know it's a fascinating historical debate, but there's nothing in the text of the Constitution that prohibits the president from pardoning himself. There's only two restrictions on the pardon power that are listed in the Constitution. One is for treason, and one is for impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
And as a general principle of reading law stuff, as we call it, if there's a grant of power with two explicit exceptions, that suggests there are no other exceptions.
Right. You know, you're the expert here, Ron. If he was not convicted in the federal court cases, or if he were to pardon himself, and I don't know where that lands, how does he wiggle out of the two state cases in New York and Georgia? If elected, could he bring those cases to the Supreme Court, which is stacked in Trump's favor with the Republicans' unconscionable maneuver of blocking President Obama from nominating Merrick Garland to the court? But then he turns around and nominates Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Coney Barrett. He's got a 6-3 GOP SCOTUS. Could he quash the cases in New York and Georgia?
He could not quash the state cases directly. What he could do, and there's good authority for this, is to claim as president, as the elected president of the United States, trials on those cases
mm-hmm.
have to be deferred until after he finishes his presidency. And that's an argument I think he would win. And then what happens, you know, in 2028 is anybody's guess. I mean, by that time, he may have figured out a way to put both Fani Willis, the district attorney in Fulton County, and Alvin Bragg, the district attorney in Manhattan, find a way to put them both in prison himself under some sort of, you know, weaponized federal prosecution. So
I mean, that's not realistic, but do you think?
I hear what the man says,
right?
And I've seen what the man does.
I mean, he's capable of anything,
right? And he certainly has proclaimed very, very publicly that he's going to wreak vengeance on Bragg, on Willis. So I don't know what he'll do, but he certainly will not go to state prison if he's elected president of the United States of America until mm-hmm. after he finishes his term.
Right. Well, listen, enough about Trump. We could talk about him all day. Here's an item about you from an old edition of the Wall Street Journal.
Ah.
Ron Cuby has represented what he has described as an eclectic group of highly reviled individuals, earning him both praise and derision. His style, aggressive, loquacious, is at times scathing. Oh, that's quite a description there, Ron.
I like that. I'm okay with that so far. Continue.
Okay. Well, as mentioned in the intro, New York's vigilante shooter Bernard Goetz, terrorist Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, mass murderer Colin Ferguson. Also, you have been involved in the case of the daughter of Malcolm X, accused of plotting to kill Louis Farrakhan, the leader of the Nation of Islam. And you've even represented the Hell's Angels. What attracts you to these cases? Why defend these people?
Well, I did not defend Bernard Goetz, to the contrary.
No, I know that. But
yeah, I represented his most reviled victim, poor Daryl Cabey, who was shot in the back by Bernard Goetz. One thing is, these are the folks that call me. Yeah, why are you representing so-and-so and not me? Well, yeah, she called, you didn't. What can I say? But more important, in all of those cases, what I've seen is the use of state power, of the power to criminalize and the power to incarcerate, being used in an unfair fashion and often for improper purposes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Colin Ferguson is a good example, the Long Island Railroad gunman massacred a group of people, just celebrated or commemorated the 30th anniversary of that shooting. And it was our position that the man was a delusional paranoid and that he should be packed off to a secure mental institution and receive mental health care unless and until he's fit to stand trial. He was not competent to stand trial, but they wanted a trial. They wanted this very public display of anger and vengeance and everything else. And all they succeeded in doing was empowering Colin Ferguson and giving him the stage that he always craved, thought that was a bad idea, thought it was unconstitutional. At the time, still think so. I maintained, to take another case, that Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman was not guilty of the charges that he faced. Subsequent years, I've revised my opinions about a lot of people, but the evidence that I've seen over the years only has reconfirmed the fact that I believed him to be, and in fact, he was an innocent person who died in America's prisons in order to appease a tyrannical Egyptian government.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Hell's Angels as a group, I kind of like them.
Why?
Well, it's funny because today in America, they are people who are completely uninterested in money or fame. They're very much like the old English concept of outlaws. They live outside society's laws, and they don't want anything from society. And if the whole world were just Hell's Angels and strippers, the Hell's Angels would be fine. Right? And to me, they're not interested in bothering civilians, the rest of us. They want to ride. They want to ride without a helmet. They want to ride with their brothers.
Yeah, but they're also involved in drugs and a lot of thievery, and they're not a nice group of people.
Well, they certainly some members have been involved in narcotics distribution, and I haven't represented anybody in those cases, but that's just like saying, you know, the priesthood has been involved in pedophilia scandals.
Right.
So I don't, you know, they don't steal. And what's more, people don't steal from them. It's weird that way. Yeah. As to nice, I don't know. I think nice is overrated. They're a group of people who, in my long experience with them, are very much committed to the notion of respect.
Respect for them? Respect for
what? They give respect and they expect respect. They will treat others respectfully as long as they are treated respectfully. And you know what? There's a critical enough shortage of respect in America today across the political spectrum that I kind of appreciate it.
Can I get back to the Sheikh for a minute?
Sure.
You believe that he was not guilty?
Yes.
Why do you believe that?
Because there was really no evidence to suggest, let alone prove, that he in any way masterminded the World Trade Center bombings or the subsequent conspiracy to blow up the bridges and tunnels. There was an informer who was a former Egyptian colonel who had kept a book of his torture victims and who ultimately was paid by your tax dollars over $1 million, who would constantly try to get Sheikh Omar to say incriminating things. And none of the things the Sheikh said were particularly incriminating, but they weren't great things, right? They weren't the kinds of things you want somebody to say. And it was, you know, very clear to me that he was trying to keep a handle on his most extreme followers so they would not engage in acts of terrorism in the United States of America. And the way you do that is you listen to people and you calm them down and you tell them, no, that would not be a good thing to do, rather than what people listening to the tapes expect to hear, which is, Ahmed, how dare you say such a thing? May a thousand camels defecate on the graves of your ancestors forever for even thinking such a thing about this great country. That's what people want to hear. And when they don't hear that, they think they're all a part of it.
But he was convicted.
Yes, he was. And that didn't surprise me, given the sentiment that prevailed at the time. I don't think he would be convicted on the same evidence today. I think there's a good deal more skepticism of law enforcement and the use of informers in 2023 than there was in 1995. A lot of people got convicted in the 80s and 90s who subsequently have been proved to be innocent and certainly would never have been convicted today.
What's it like for you, though, as an attorney, to be involved in such a high-level case with such a huge spotlight on this case and tons of press, police, the FBI, the CIA? I mean, everyone is involved in a situation like that.
You know, the first thing I do when I know I'm in a high profile case, I make sure I declare all my income on my taxes. For a small businessman, I think I'm the most honest one out there. You know, has there been a $100 bill that somebody gave me that didn't make its way onto my 1099? Yeah, probably. But other than that, no, I live a very clean life. I don't break the law. I know where the limits are. So as a result, I'm not particularly worried about retribution.
Beyond that, though, Ron, beyond being clean, what's it like to be in the eye of the storm in a high-level case? I mean, that was the World Trade Center. I mean, I remember that very clearly. And the people coming out of there, were there seven people killed?
Yeah, yeah.
And those people coming out just charred with smoke and barely able to breathe and a truck bomb?
What's most important to me when I'm in one of those cases, and I know that people are actually listening to what I say, is to try to come to those cases from what I believe to be a moral position, which is, yes, the victims suffered horribly. Yes, indeed, the attack on the Trade Center was an act of terrorism. Mm-hmm. And yes, indeed, Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman knew many of the participants involved, as in fact did the FBI. But he did not direct or request or importune this thing to happen. Mm-hmm. And to try to provide basically sort of a counter narrative. You know, people would go to Sheikh Omar and ask him religious questions. Mm-hmm. For example, one of his followers asked him, is it acceptable or unacceptable? Is it halal or haram to attack the United Nations?
Well, and that means what? Halal or haram?
Acceptable is okay, is kosher, mm-hmm. is halal. Yes, mm-hmm. halal, mm-hmm. go ahead. Okay. Haram is prohibited. No, uh-huh. you cannot do that. So he was asked very point blank, is it halal or haram to attack the United Nations?
Can I back up to Colin Ferguson for a minute?
Sure.
Because it was 30 years ago. A lot of people who are listening today might not even know about Colin Ferguson. He walked down the aisle of a Long Island Railroad train, commuters going home after a long day at work, and just randomly shot people as he strolled. I mean, six people were killed, 19 others were wounded, some of them gravely. I was working at WNBC at the time, and I was on that train out of Penn Station, but switched to another line out of Jamaica Station. And when I got home and watched the coverage, there didn't seem to be any doubt that Ferguson killed and severely wounded those people. I know you said he was mentally deranged, but why defend someone like that?
The answer is that we felt that Colin Ferguson, initially, we believed him to be not guilty by reason of insanity. And in the United States, our criminal code is premised on the fashion that you know the difference between right and wrong, and you can choose to act rightly or wrongly, that you're in essence making a moral choice when you do things. And that's why we don't prosecute children, right?
Right.
3- and 4-year-olds, because they lack a moral sense. It's also why we don't prosecute those who are deemed to be legally insane, because they lack the requisite moral sense.
But didn't he plan this thing out for a month ahead of time?
Sure, he did. And what was sort of fascinating about the Ferguson case was most people, especially then, viewed insanity as the same as lacking intelligence. People were unfamiliar with really smart people, as Ferguson was, who were completely insane. They would view the insane as, you're down on all fours, barking like a dog, frothing at the mouth. You have to be hit with a rolled up newspaper. That was their image of the insane. We know better now that we've seen people like Jeffrey Dahmer and other serial killers and people such as that,
right?
Who are deeply pathological, as insane as you can possibly be, yet are sophisticated and highly functioning.
Didn't Ferguson fire you defend himself?
Yes. He ultimately, we attempted to have him incompetent to stand trial. There was a hearing on that, and everybody agreed that he was a delusional paranoid. The only question, that is the prosecution and the defense experts both agreed on that. The only question was, did he meet this very, very low standard for competence? The judge wanted a trial. He said he'd perfectly competent. Ferguson fired us and represented himself. He went from being our client to our colleague. And the trial, how much of a disaster circus was the trial? It was so much of a circus that it ended up as a Saturday Night Live episode.
I mean, which is beyond belief. But
yeah.
I mean, when you take on a case like that, and thinking of Carolyn McCarthy, who became our congresswoman out here in Long Island, and her husband was killed, her son suffered a horrible wound to the head, was disabled. Do people hate you as a result of defending people like Ferguson?
Yeah, of course they do. And look, I don't expect anything different from victims of the people that I represent. I'm not looking for their approval or their forgiveness or an attaboy or anything. I have a role in this system, and it's a role that I take on voluntarily to make sure that people's rights are respected and the criminal justice system does not overreach. And that's what I do. And that's what I tried to do in the Colin Ferguson case. And look, if you want to be loved, start raising dogs.
Well, speaking of terrorists like the Sheikh, you also represented El-Sayed Nasser, the assassin of the late Rabbi Meir Kahane. Who
depends
was
which jury you believe. If you believe the state jury, he was not guilty of assassinating Rabbi Meir Kahane.
Okay.
If you believe the federal jury, he was guilty of assassinating. So I will qualify your introduction.
All right. This was a guy who your own father admired for a while, Meir Kahane.
As did I.
But you defended his assassin. Why?
Well, whatever youthful admiration that I had for Meir Kahane in 1971.
Was that long ago? Huh?
Yeah. That's when I knew him back in 71. I'm old. his subsequent quarter century as a racist, anti-Arab, vicious, provocateur in Israel change that opinion? I mean, look, he was expelled from the Knesset for anti-Arab racism. Do you have any idea how bad you have to be in Israel to be expelled from the Knesset for anti-Arab racism?
I think pretty bad.
Really bad.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I actually, while I don't approve of political assassination as a tool of social change, I did think that the ending of Kahana probably saved the lives of thousands and thousands and thousands of people.
How?
By preventing this man from continuing his movement to extra legally terrorize and expel Arab citizens of Israel, as well as people living in the occupation.
Kind of like echoes of today, right?
Yeah, well, I, of course, you know, like so many things, if you could go back and look at that then and compare it with this now, you might say, you know what? Actually was better then. Kanahara.
You also once had to sit in the witness chair and testify in the trial of John Gotti Jr., the son of John Gotti, the Gambino mafia boss. Now, this case involved the kidnapping of your WABC radio co-host, Curtis Sliwa, founder of the Guardian Angels, an unarmed crime prevention organization. Now, this was a kidnapping and attempted murder trial. Tell me about why you were involved.
Yeah, why was I involved? You know, it's something when a high-profile defendant subpoenas you to testify as a defense witness against, like, the very guy you sit next to every morning who he allegedly tried to kill. Right?
Yes.
You know? So what had happened was, back in the mid-90s, and I forget the year, there was a huge mafia takedown out of White Plains. There were like 40 people indicted. Denny McClain was indicted, the last guy to win 30 games in baseball, right?
That's right.
Detroit Tigers, Denny was indicted. A whole bunch of people were indicted, and the head of the indictment was John Gotti, the younger son of John Gotti. I had a client whose mafia name was Sigmund the Sea Monster. yeah. Okay. Not like the old school, right? You know, Benny the Weasel, Jimmy the Butcher, Sigmund the Sea Monster? Really? But I had known John's father, John Gotti, and I had known John as, you know, seen him did various things as he was growing up, and he trusted me. And it came to pass that he wanted to negotiate sort of a global plea of guilty. He would have been the first alleged mafia boss to plead guilty. Because what happens is these guys, they don't snitch, right? They go to trial, they get convicted, they get 50 years, 100 years, 35 years. And John was sort of sick of that. He saw where that life, you know, landed everybody, including his father. Mm-hmm. So he was kind of done with this. Didn't want to be the head of the Gambino crime family. Didn't want to spend the rest of his life in prison. And really wanted to get out by negotiating a guilty plea, and everybody would, you know, do a little bit of time and move on. And I was designated to do
that.
And
his dad, John Gotti, didn't want him to take that plea.
There was, like all family discussions, it was complicated, Jim.
Yeah. To say the least.
Yeah. But ultimately, the deal I was trying to negotiate kind of fell apart, although subsequently there were deals made and everybody did end up pleading guilty. So John Gotti's defense to the conspiracy charge was that he withdrew from the conspiracy. That he had said, no more, I'm done with this, before the people who ended up kidnapping Curtis ended up kidnapping Curtis. And so I was basically called to testify about my dealings and my conversations with John during that period of time.
All right, but they didn't just kidnap him. They shot Curtis Sliwa.
Right. They shot him. We still don't know how many times, but it was multiple. But John was not charged with doing that. In fact, one of the guys that did that ended up becoming a witness for Team America for the government, which just goes to show there's no crime too serious in America that cannot be forgiven and rewarded if you just sign up and become an informer. And so John wasn't charged with doing the shooting or aiding and abetting the shooting. He was charged with a conspiracy, and I had a small piece of evidence to give, and I gave it. And ultimately, the jury, I think, hung again. Another mistrial was declared, third time, I think, and the government just gave up trying to prosecute him. And as far as I know, he's gone off to live a life that has had nothing to do with organized crime, that indeed he did withdraw. He did retire from leadership of the Gambino crime family and has lived the law-abiding and somewhat normal life ever since.
Well, your radio show on WABC, Curtis and QB, it was one of the highly rated programs in New York. That's where we met as I was reporting for Business Week to the ABC radio network. Now, you and Curtis didn't agree politically at all, but he called you a Judas for your testimony, for telling the truth under oath in a court of law. How did he expect you to testify?
Right. Well, of course, I have no idea. And for me to be Judas, that would make him Christ, which not so sure you want to go there.
He was a Jesuit. He didn't want to become a priest.
He's on his like fifth ex-wife. Okay.
Yeah.
In any event, Curtis's bad feelings about that, it was an interesting lesson for me, because Curtis plays a character, this bloviating Joe Sixpack working class guy who speaks common sense to the working class of people. That's his persona.
And he wants to be in the limelight.
But he gets too caught up in the character sometimes. And then the stuff that he does and says is a reaction to the character. So he knew I was testifying. He was fine with it. In fact, we joked about it on the air before I went down there. But somebody told him something. So he decided to change from, you know, the attitude he had to the attitude he took on. Threatened at one point in the New York Post that if I show up at work Monday, he's going to attack me. And at that point, I just went to the bosses of the station and said, I don't know what you guys feel about hostile workplace, but my coworker threatening to assault me on the front page of the freaking New York Post.
Yeah,
probably we should have a little talk. And we did, and everything was fine. I mean, look, it was a radio show that I tried to inform, but the purpose of the show was to entertain people.
Right.
And we were both paid really good money for doing that. If either one of us decided we could not stomach the other, we were perfectly free to blow up the show, walk away from high six figures, and live our lives. So we decided to
vote. That's what happened.
Right. And that's ultimately what happened. I got fired after management changed. And,
right.
You know, talk and radio now has become this sort of bilious cesspool of angry old white people whose prime demographic is 75 to dirt.
Let's switch gears again. Tell me about the case of Kubila Shabazz.
Kubila Shabazz.
The daughter of Malcolm X.
She was the daughter. She is the daughter of Malcolm X.
And in 1965, she witnessed the assassination of her father by three gunmen.
Right.
And 30 years later in 1995, she is arrested for allegedly plotting to kill Louis Farrakhan, the leader of the Nation of Islam, noted for his anti-Semitic and racist anti-white rhetoric. Now, Shabazz believed her father was assassinated and Farrakhan was involved. She maintained her innocence and accepted a plea agreement. What was that case like?
Well, it was an odd case because the role of Louis Farrakhan in Malcolm's death really has never been fully discussed in the American public.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there was this huge split in the Nation of Islam, and Malcolm went one way and broke with Elijah Muhammad, the founder, and Farrakhan went another way and stayed loyal to him. And ultimately, that came to fruition in the Audubon Ballroom, where Malcolm was assassinated. Interesting, just last year, two of the people who were convicted of assassinating him were ultimately cleared by mm-hmm. the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. One had died in prison and the other is still among us. And so the role that the FBI played in Malcolm's death has also been sort of under discussed. But Kubilo, who had fairly serious psychological issues, was convinced that Farrakhan had something to do with her father's murder, and she conspired with an old classmate of hers, a nice white Jewish boy, in fact.
Michael Fitzpatrick.
Yeah, I think he was Jewish. Maybe he wasn't. Maybe he was maybe the Fitzpatrick. Anyway, who remembers? But, you know, this the guy who was an FBI informer and kind of a dirtbag. And so right. they had a lot of bad conversations that sound bad on tape. Never would have gone anywhere. But he, seeking favor with the FBI, turned her in. It became a big case because... Mm-hmm. However you people felt about Farrakhan, they felt a lot of sympathy for Kubilo. Watching your father gunned down,
right.
you know, in front of an audience of people is probably one, when you're a little child, is probably a fairly traumatic event.
Now, she took a plea on that, didn't
and she?
She
ended up taking a no jail plea, and we have not, like, heard much from her again, except her son, Malcolm, died a few years ago in Mexico,
right.
which is also very yeah. sad.
You know, an interesting sidelight here, as I was doing a little bit of research, I didn't know that Farrakhan was a calypso singer who used the stage name Calypso Gene. Did
yeah.
you know that?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's how he got his start in life, as a calypso.
He's a showman.
Yeah, well, look, I got my start as a cultural anthropologist. I mean, you know, people shouldn't hold anthropology against me.
No, I guess not.
Ron, let's
end where we began, faith and trust in our legal system. But where do we go from here? If we have a Trump election, which is very possible, what can we expect the courts to look like after another four-year term?
I don't know. If Trump gets reelected and he does what he's vowed to do, I think that's probably the end of the American democratic experiment. Mm-hmm. as we know it. Mm-hmm. And I've really never said that before. We've gone through a lot of presidents that I viewed as very bad, that other people viewed as very bad. Richard Nixon was certainly a threat, but nothing like what we see in Donald Trump. People hated Jimmy Carter for what they perceived to be his weakness, yet he's a beloved figure today.
Right.
And I have never sounded the alarm about American democracy. I spent so many years as kind of a revolutionary wanting to get rid of it that I began mm-hmm. to appreciate its resilience mm-hmm. and its strength under pressure. But I don't think we've seen anything like this before. And hopefully this will be the last time we see something like a resurgent Trump. If not, I will have a very, very different and unrecognizable place.
Well, let's just say that President Biden is reelected. The courts during the last 3 years have become far more diverse. A lot of women, people of color, have made it to the courts, and it's become more representative of the American public. I would imagine we would see more of that, and that trend would continue if he's reelected.
I think that that's right. And in places that aren't governed by congressional GOP majority, like the state of New York, we have a very diverse bench in New York State. And despite the fact that liberals have appointed every judge on the high court, it is a very, very balanced court.
Mm-hmm.
It's center-leaning liberal, but not defund the police. You'll
right.
be pleased to know.
Right, right. Yeah.
So I would hope that another 4 years of Biden, or as many years as we get from him, would continue the process of making the judiciary more resemble the people that it ultimately rules over.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hope so. And Ron, we were almost out of time. Let's explore the court system and all of its idiosyncrasies again in the future. And hopefully justice prevails with Donald Trump, that all Americans are treated equally under the law, no matter if you're the president or not. And that's a big ask, considering that money talks and political power talks. And if you can afford the best lawyers, Ron, I mean, your chances of getting off improve markedly. I mean, I learned that covering the so-called trial of the century, O.J. Simpson, and for American Journal. Any disagreement that money can buy justice and by an acquittal?
Well, I respectfully don't fully embrace that.
Okay.
That is to say, if you can afford the best legal team and the best experts, you are well ahead of most defendants, and you have a much better chance of a favorable outcome. But it's hardly a done deal. And I've seen in my 40 years of doing this, what convicts people most often, what gets them found guilty, is the evidence. And even the best lawyers can't make that evidence go away. And so I think that my advice to people who are about to encounter the legal system or thinking about encountering the legal system is, seriously, the reason most people like go to prison is they commit crimes. So try not to.
So bottom line,
you'd have to pay a lot. You'd have to pay $900 an hour to get that from me in a private consultation.
Yeah, well,
Paymar.
So bottom line for you is you still have faith in the judicial system as it stands today.
I still have faith and I still have hope.
Okay. All right.
And I just think, how much, as bad as things are, I just try to think, how much worse would they be if we weren't doing what we were doing?
Well, listen, Ron, thank you so much for joining us today. You are always an interesting character. And you have a lot to say, and you've fought a lot of great fights over a long period of time, and we will return to many of these subjects in the future, I hope.
I hope so too, Jim. Always great to hear your voice. You take good care, and your audience as well.
All right. I'm Jim Paymar, and you've been listening to The Big Shift, available wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening today, and stay tuned for the next episode of The Big Shift with Jim Paymar. It's coming soon.